Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hey, everybody. Patrick here. So we've done a few episodes over the years on peasants, and I wanted to revisit these older episodes and put them back out there for you to listen to. Hopefully, you enjoyed our rebroadcast on peasants and the medieval countryside back at the end of October. In this episode, we're going to continue to look at peasants and common folk and see how their changing circumstances led to major revolts and rebellions in the later Middle Ages. Thanks for joining me today, and enjoy the show. It began with a buzzing hum. 100 voices speaking at once hung in the summer air, melding a touch of menace with the oppressive humidity. One of those voices resolved into something clearer. We're not paying any more taxes. Dozens of peasants crowded around a table where a single man was seated. The peasants all looked at him with anticipation after this. An account book sat in front of the man. The pen he held in his hand quivered just the tiniest bit. No one noticed a single drop of ink falling onto the crisp parchment page. The man wore a scarlet velvet jerkin, an expensive piece of fancy clothing. It contrasted with the plain woolens, stained with sweat and dirt, that the peasants wore. The richly dressed man looked up from the account book, now soiled with that single blot of ink. "Stay back," the man said, "or I'll have you all arrested." That buzz began again, more intensely than before. A hardy man stepped forward out of the crowd. "I said we're not paying any more taxes. We paid last winter, we paid you, right here, not 3 months ago. We're not paying any more." A chorus of agreement rose from the mass of peasants. Fear crept onto the tax collector's face as he tried to hold his pen steady. His two burly assistants had beaten up recalcitrant peasants before, and they'd hauled many others off to prison. But this was different. They wanted no part of this. "You'll all be arrested. The bishop himself will hear of this." The hardy peasant leaned in close over the table. The tax collector could smell sweat, ale, and tilled dirt on him. He growled, "I think you should mark down in that book that we've paid what's due." The emboldened crowd pushed closer. The man behind the table could see daggers, mallets, and a few rocks waiting, presumably for him. He sweat into his velvet jerkin. The pen quivered in his hand. He made a decision. Better to face the bishop than wind up dead and buried in a ditch, never to be found. A few scratches of his pen, and it looked like the inhabitants of the village had indeed paid the tax that was owed. As fast as he could, the tax collector and his two assistants got onto their horses and rode out of the village. Common folk didn't just accept the indignities that went along with being on the bottom of the medieval social order. They resisted. Underneath the seemingly placid surface of medieval society lay deep currents of anger, discontent, and rebellion. It regularly boiled over into full-on revolt. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Tides of History. The society of the Middle Ages was hierarchical in a way that's hard for us to understand today. Ideas about social mobility and equality before the law are built deep into our perception of the world that we live in. Obviously, the gap between ideal and reality is pretty dang wide, but at least in theory, we can rise and fall on our merits, and the law is supposed to apply to all of us in the same way. This is the cornerstone of modern and postmodern liberal, in the 18th century sense of the term, democracy. The Middle Ages did not operate with those same fundamental assumptions. There was an order to society that placed kings, nobles, bishops, and abbots on top, and grubby-fingered town-dwelling artisans and merchants, and especially dirt-farming peasants, below them. To them, this order was good, maybe even divinely ordained. Elites looked down their noses at their social inferiors both literally, since their higher standard of living led to them being taller, and figuratively. There was no doubt in your average knight's mind that the peasants who tilled his land belonged in their place. Extracting rents, tolls, fines, and labor services from peasants was what made both religious and secular elites, well, elite. But common people, both peasants and town/city dwellers, did not just accept a state of affairs that stuck them on the bottom of the social ladder. They resisted in ways both small and large. Sometimes that meant taking it easy on days when they were forced to plow the Lord's fields. At other points, the result was bloody social revolution, storming into the Lord's manor house and gutting him at his dinner table. Those large revolts could leave thousands dead. By constantly working on that scale between low-level resentment and full-on class war, it's obvious that medieval society was no harmonious, hierarchical utopia where everybody knew their place. Simmering tensions and ongoing injustices erupted regularly into open rebellion. That's what we'll talk about here today. We'll go over the broad shape of revolts. When, where, how, and most important of all, why. The reasons common folk rose up against their social betters were usually more complex than simple anger at the system. After we've established the context, we'll explore a few major revolts. We'll look at the great Flemish peasant uprising of the 1320s, the 1358 Jacquerie in France, the Chiampi Revolt in Florence in 1378, and then we'll spend a bunch of time on the enormous 1381 rebellion in England. As we get started on this, it's important to note that there's a good reason we haven't spent a ton of time on peasants beforehand. It's because it's not the easiest topic to work with. The vast majority of peasants were completely illiterate. They did not leave behind much for us to study. We don't have a peasant's diary telling us how he felt about doing forced labor for the lord of the manor he lived on. We don't have a letter from a peasant woman who brewed ale telling us how she felt about the taxes the political authorities imposed on her product. Really understanding the lives of peasants means a lot of squeezing unsuitable sources for everything they're worth, and then a ton of reading between the lines. That is especially true of peasant resistance. Most of the sources about the common folk and their revolts were written by the elites who had to deal with them. As a result, their understanding of the reasons behind those uprisings isn't necessarily accurate. They're not especially sympathetic to them either. On a more basic level, they weren't even likely to record day-to-day forms of unrest, even if they recognized it as it was happening. Whole regions where we'd expect to see a lot of resistance, like Sicily and southern Italy, are effectively blank spots on the map. With all of that said, careful investigations by a whole bunch of talented scholars have uncovered mass resistance and rebellion in the Middle Ages. That is why we can't say that this was a harmonious society. Tensions and injustices were built into the system. Peasants and townspeople weren't stupid. They understood their place in the hierarchy. They also understood what their options for resistance were. They were also much, much more aware of broader political trends and current events than we might imagine. They had strong opinions on those things. As the Middle Ages went on, those ongoing tensions increasingly flared up. In the years after the Black Death, we hear of a litany of disturbances of increasing size. Now, part of this is that our sources for the years after about 1300 are much better than they were before that. But there also seems to have been a genuine increase in revolts, especially major ones, after 1350 or so. What gives? The biggest reason, according to the historian Samuel Cohn in a great book called Lust for Liberty, was a new understanding of the word liberty itself. Earlier in the Middle Ages, liberty meant something like a specific set of privileges restricted to an elite group. As time went on, the meaning shifted to something more like a general implicit sense of equality, the idea of liberty that we understand today. Cohn stresses that this shift looks like the emergence of a genuinely new political ideology, maybe born of the stresses and sorrows of the Black Death. Cohn sums this up, quote, "From utter despondency in the wake of Europe's most monumental mortality, peasants, workers, artisans and petty shopkeepers became emboldened with a new self and class confidence. After the Black Death, both north and south of the Alps, they organized collectively, and with increased frequency, they revolted to change the here and now, to gain liberty, to preserve their dignity, and to expand their rights and those of their communities." That's a great quote, but we have a lot to unpack here. On the most basic level, it tells us that common folk, everybody from urban workers to rural peasants, increasingly exercised their agency. They were actively shaping the world they lived in both a social and a political sense. We also learned that this was a widespread phenomenon. All over Europe, Italy, France, Spain, the Low Countries, England, Germany, there was new unrest. Cohen actually quantifies this. His in-depth sample of revolts covers Italy, the Low Countries, and France. Between 1200 and 1348, he found 470 instances, 2.73 revolts per year. Between 1348 and 1425, Cohen found a whopping 621, 8.06 revolts per year. Again, part of that is just that the sources get better and more plentiful as the Middle Ages go on. We would expect to see more recorded for 1425 than we would for 1200. But that doesn't explain why there were so many more in the 1370s than the 1330s, when the sources shouldn't be that much different. This tells us that the difference was indeed the Black Death. There were other factors, too. The whole complex of the Great Transition that we talked about a couple of months ago, including war, famine, and the drastically shifting climate of the 14th and 15th centuries. But mostly, it was plague and the massive demographic shift that went along with it. We've talked about this before, but prior to the Black Death, peasants were under tremendous strain. The favorable climate of the 12th and 13th centuries had given way to much colder and less stable conditions. Devastating rainfall ruined harvests and caused famines, and harvest yields went down. But the population was still high, which meant that rents and land prices were through the roof. There wasn't much available land either. After the Black Death, with population pressure easing, land prices and rents dropped drastically. Wages went way, way up. On paper, this looks like a recipe for decreasing tensions. After all, lower rents and more available land meant happier, healthier, and wealthier common folk. There would be less reason for them to be angry about the structures of their lives. The problem was that landlords and other elite groups didn't want to give up those high rents, land prices, and demands for peasant labor. This was a recipe for serious conflict between an old order and a new one. The old social structure was creaking and increasingly less suited to the material circumstances of post-plague society. This made upheaval inevitable. The other aspect of these conflicts was politics. A better-off common folk was more likely to be invested in political life than a miserable one. Now, again, this might seem a bit strange. There were no democracies in the late Middle Ages. Outside of a few cities in Italy, and then only temporarily, there was no real popular element in government at all. But that doesn't mean that common folk didn't have opinions about politics or feel that they should have no input. Remember, laws put forth by kings or representative bodies like Parliament affected them. Indirectly, like when enemy armies might burn their crops in some feckless war brought on by the king, or directly through taxation. Especially after the Black Death, common folk increasingly made themselves heard on political matters. In fact, the vast majority of the revolts we know about in this period were about politics, not about the basic injustices of medieval society. This is tricky, because often politics and those injustices were intertwined. Social and economic issues weren't necessarily separable from political ones. But when we know about the specific reasons behind a particular revolt, the uselessness of the king or the imposition of some new tax or law was a far more likely cause than a complaint about unfairness in the social structure. With that said, there are some major exceptions to that, where that unfairness was the central issue. Those exceptions tended to be the biggest revolts of this whole period, like the English Rebellion of 1381 or the Great German Peasants' War of 1525. So, with all this in mind, we can come to a general picture of common folks' revolts in the Middle Ages. They involved both peasants and the urban residents of towns and cities. They had a number of causes, but it seems like politics were the most proximate and frequent issue, rather than fundamental injustice. There were plenty of revolts earlier in the Middle Ages, but the Black Death marked a fundamental turning point. It was both a material cause and one that affected the mentalities of everyday people. Practical conflicts over resources and social structure grew more pertinent, and the mass shock of death may have given rise to a new understanding of liberty itself. The result was a wave of social conflict that marked the end of the Middle Ages.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The uprising that cropped up over and over again during the late Middle Ages took place all across Europe. They took a variety of forms. Some were rural, others were entirely urban. Others still spanned both the cities and the countryside. They happened for a variety of reasons, and they could look much different. Some were shockingly violent. Others were effectively mass protests that achieved their goals completely peacefully. I mentioned earlier that unrest was constant. Per Samuel Cohn's estimate, we know of 1,091 instances of open revolt just in Italy, France, and the Low Countries between 1200 and 1425. There were many others elsewhere, and there were still more that were never mentioned in sources that survive today. Whole regions are a black hole. All of those incidents leave aside the everyday forms of resistance that writers either didn't notice or didn't think were worth talking about. These are the kinds of things common to peasant societies even today. The anthropologist James C. Scott lists this everyday resistance in a really influential book on the topic called Weapons of the Weak. According to Scott, everyday resistance took the form of foot dragging, dissimulation, desertion, false compliance, pilfering, feigned ignorance, slander, arson, and sabotage. In other words, peasants played dumb, they worked slowly, they ran away, they stole, and generally made nuisances of themselves, all the while trying to avoid any sort of attention for their behavior. Better to be thought lazy and stupid, common peasant stereotypes, than a rebel. And yet, every once in a while, those everyday forms of resistance boiled over into something much more meaningful. Even before the Black Death, Flanders, in the Low Countries just north of France and today's Belgium, was a hotbed of insurrection. Just as a note, for all of this next section, I'm drawing on an informative book by the historian William H. Tibraca called A Plague of Insurrection. We've talked about Flanders before. It was home to cities like Bruges and Ghent, the flourishing trade and industrial centers where the commercial revolution of the High Middle Ages flourished. It was one of the richest and most densely populated regions of Europe, right up there with northern Italy in terms of per capita wealth and population density. Politically, though, Flanders was a bit of a mess. It had been an independent and powerful county for most of the High Middle Ages, but that changed toward the end of the 13th century. The French king Philip the Fair, remember that guy? Made an aggressive grab for Flanders. By 1300, Philip had occupied the entirety of Flanders and displaced the count. This led directly to a series of disturbances, street fighting in Bruges and Ghent, and then a massive popular uprising. An army of Flemish peasants and townspeople utterly defeated a force of French knights at the Battle of Courtrai in 1302. This French defeat, known as the Battle of the Golden Spurs, for all the gold spurs left behind by dead French knights, probably should have led to Flemish independence. Instead, all it did was buy the Count a temporary peace. The Count of Flanders agreed to pay a large indemnity to Philip the Fair in return for semi-autonomy in Flanders. And who would bear the burden of taxation to pay that indemnity? Well, the Flemish townspeople and peasants, of course. As you can imagine, they were not particularly happy about this, and they spent the 2 decades following the Battle of Courtrai in 1302 in minor spats, protests, and rebellions. Things really heated up in 1322, though, with the death of old Count Robert. Flanders passed to his grandson, the 18-year-old Louis of Nevers. Louis wasn't just politically inexperienced. He had spent his entire life in France, mostly at the French court, and he declared himself a loyal vassal of the French king. That didn't go over well in Flanders, where they had just spent decades fighting against French attempts to take over the county. Even for an experienced and gifted ruler, Flanders would have been a handful. William Tebraca points out that the popular political culture in the county was the most complex and deepest anywhere outside the cities of northern Italy. In Flanders, both the cities and the countryside supported strong ideas about rulers' responsibilities to their subjects and subjects' ability to protest their rulers' actions. Louis of Nevers was not an experienced and gifted ruler. He got himself in trouble literally within months of succeeding his grandfather. The first sign of trouble came in Bruges, the wealthy trading city just off the North Sea coast. The city called out its militia and defeated a pro-Louis force near Sluis, Bruges' port, in a bloody little battle. Things got worse after that. Louis and his uncle, who was also an important noble in Flanders, decided to collect not only their normally high taxes, but also all the arrears left over from previous years, everything that hadn't been paid. As a result, riots and protests broke out in the countryside. Peasants systematically organized to obstruct any collection of taxes by the county's officials. They called meetings and appointed representatives to lead a rebellion. This was direct action. The peasant rebels physically seized magistrates, administrators, and even lords. Tebraca writes, quote, "The image we should have in mind here is that of large numbers of people assembling, chanting, milling about, and shouting threats in front of or around one or more of the intended victims." They went further, too. They attacked and destroyed the houses of the noble families those tax-collecting officials belonged to. The peasants' complaints were detailed and sophisticated. Taxation itself wasn't the problem. Instead, they thought the tax burden was being unfairly apportioned. They also thought its collection was arrogant, arbitrary, and corrupt. The count was unpopular and overly French at a time when those tensions had been running high for decades. In other words, this was a political revolt, not a social revolution. At least, that was the case in the beginning. The first wave of rebellion in 1323 and 1324 had achieved substantial successes. The peasants drove the count to the bargaining table, and the rural rebels had forged alliances with the inhabitants of cities, especially Bruges. The limits of the possible seemed to be opening up, and soon, the overall goal expanded to eliminating aristocratic privilege in the countryside altogether. Nobles driven from their holdings started to fight back. They burned peasant homes and executed them without trial, whether they were involved with the uprising or not. By 1325, huge swaths of rural Flanders were in open revolt. Peasant armies were defeating noble forces in open battle. Things went from bad to worse when Count Louis, holed up in the city of Courtrai, decided to burn one of the suburbs to make it more defensible against attack. This backfired. The fire spread into the city itself, and the citizens of Courtrai attacked Count Louis and his entourage. Louis himself was captured and handed over to the militia of Bruges, and his most important nobles were killed. But this wasn't the end. King Charles IV of France was the feudal overlord of Count Louis. Moreover, popular rebellion in one of the richest areas of Europe, one right next door to his own kingdom, was hardly a precedent he wanted to encourage. So Charles IV turned up the pressure. He got the Flemish bishops to excommunicate the rebels and forbade all trade between France and Flanders. Seeing this happen, the rebels who held Louis extracted a promise of amnesty for all of them and released him. Louis, of course, immediately reneged on his promise. With the threat of the king's intervention behind him, Louis extracted a crushing peace agreement from the rebels. The peace agreement didn't totally kill the revolt. Certain areas remained in more or less open rebellion. It was a given that the French king would eventually intervene. Now, Charles IV was the last of the large adult sons of Philip the Fair. When Charles died, he was replaced by Philip VI, the first Valois king. The same dynamic that led Philip VI into conflict with the English king Edward III to kick off the Hundred Years' War played out here. Philip VI was new, he was weak, and he needed to prove that he belonged on the throne of France. What better way to do that than by supporting a vassal in trouble, a guy like Count Louis? The result was nothing short of slaughter. The peasant rebels made a bold attack on Philip VI and Count Louis, but in the end, they were crushed. At the conclusion of the battle, 3,185 Flemish peasants were dead. Count Louis had Flanders back in his hands, and the rebellion was over. Noble vengeance was swift and brutal. Peasant captains were decapitated or broken on the rack without a trial. Towns and cities lost their privileges and charters of rights. The count exercised much stronger, more centralized control. The rebellion failed utterly after its initial successes, but those successes were still remarkable. Outside of the Hussite rebellion in Bohemia in the next century, it lasted the longest, almost 5 years, and for a while, it successfully administered a large and wealthy region. The tradition of popular politics it represented stuck around. Flanders would rebel again and again and again over the next century, often with great success. King Philip VI of France had played a key role in crushing the Flemish rebellion, but his own lands would be the next to suffer in a major way. As we've talked about now at great length, the opening stages of the Hundred Years' War went pretty poorly for the kings of France. Philip VI's prosecution of the war was a disaster, from his crushing naval defeat at Sluys to the somehow even worse loss at Crécy in 1346. His son, John the Good, somehow did even worse. The Black Death after 1348 certainly didn't help matters either. The defeat at Poitiers in 1356, where John himself was captured, was disastrous. The 2 years after the Battle of Poitiers marked one of the worst points for France in the entire conflict. The Dauphin Charles, John the Good's son, faced serious unrest. He struggled to extract tax revenue from the increasingly assertive Estates General, the representative body of the kingdom. The people of Paris were openly rebellious. As bad as that sounds, things got far, far worse in late May of 1358. Seemingly overnight, the countryside north of Paris exploded into open and bloody rebellion. Peasants burned castles and manor houses. They strung up the aristocratic occupants and, if the chroniclers are to be believed, committed far worse atrocities. They burned households alive, they tortured nobles to death, and they raped. One anecdote says that peasants roasted a knight alive on a spit and repeatedly assaulted his wife. Whether that's true or not, it reflects the kinds of feverish reports that were circulating at the time. For several weeks in May and June of 1358, well-organized bands of common folk engaged in a spasm of violent activity directed at the nobility. It wasn't undirected violence either. The pattern of their attacks makes clear that they were systematically targeting strategic castles that could be used as bases against them. This series of events is known as the Jacquerie, after the generic, insulting term for a French peasant, Jacques. As quickly as it had flared up, the Jacquerie burned out. The leader of the peasants was a man named Guillaume Calais, a wealthy peasant from just south of Clermont. Calais was well-spoken and charismatic, but he made a terrible mistake in trusting the treacherous Charles of Navarre, who lured him to his camp under a parley and then captured him. Calais was executed, and then his army was run down by a combined force of French knights. That was at the beginning of June. The other groups of rebels didn't last more than a couple of weeks after that. The nobles took a terrible revenge. Any participants who weren't killed in battle or on raids were tracked back to their home villages and executed. One noble, a guy named Jean de Clermont, personally cut the hamstrings of two men, a father and a son, who had burned down his manor house. another lord took several hundred followers on a miniature chevauchée around his lands and hung or beheaded any supposed ringleaders he could find. In other places, they simply killed any peasants they ran across. By the end of June, just a month after it began, the rebellion had been brutally stamped out. At first glance, the Jacquerie seems like open social revolution, right? Peasants were attacking their social superiors. But, as far as we can tell from limited source material, the uprising wasn't really about changing the basic structures of society. The peasants had no list of demands to end feudal exactions or what have you. The participants in the revolt weren't dirt-poor, landless laborers. They were more likely to be men like Guillaume Calais, wealthy and well-respected figures within their villages. Other participants were even minor nobles or well-off artisans. In other words, these were not the desperate lower orders struggling to overturn an unfavorable system. Instead, as with the Flemish Revolt of 1323 to 1328, the Jacquerie was a fundamentally political event. The nobility of France justified their control over society by claiming to protect the land and its people from dangerous invaders. Recent events had showed just how hollow those claims were. The chronicler Jean de Venette wrote, quote, "Seeing the wrongs and oppressions inflicted on them on every side, the nobles gave them no protection but rather oppressed them as heavily as did the enemy. The nobles had failed to defend the kingdom. They had let the king get captured at Poitiers. And on top of all that, these same nobles had recently seized peasants' property on a large scale on the order of the Dauphin." So, there were both proximate and longer-term causes that drove the peasants to rebellion, but they were essentially political causes. If the nobles hadn't been incompetent, there would have been nothing to complain about. The Jacquerie was a bloody failure, like the Flemish Peasants' Revolt, but more uprisings followed in France. Moreover, not all of these politically motivated revolts took place in the countryside. Cities had been hotbeds of insurrection well before the Black Death, with cloth workers especially being pretty radical in their ideas. That continued afterward. In one example, the city of Viterbo in Italy saw a bloody riot and the deaths of a number of dignitaries after a cardinal's dog was washed in a public drinking fountain. This was in 1367. In fact, cities saw more regular unrest than the countryside. Maybe it's just better recorded, but it's likely that the density of a medieval city and the structures of urban life made rebellion more common there. The best example of these urban insurrections came in 1378 in Florence. This uprising, known as the Ciompi Revolt, was one of the most radical of the Middle Ages. It was a complex series of events, but in essence, the city's least skilled cloth workers banded together with other wage workers and guild journeymen. They explicitly called themselves the Popolo Minuto, the little people, in contrast to the Popolo Grosso, the big, wealthy people who ran the government. These common people, the Popolo Minuto, formed three new guilds. This would give them a claim on representation in Florence's government. At first glance, this looks political, if still radical in a deeply hierarchical society. Common folk were demanding a say in how their republic was run. But the Ciompi's demands went far deeper than that. Forming new guilds meant extending new economic rights to unskilled workers. Essentially, this meant economic self-determination for workers who had previously been under the strict control of Florence's cloth guild. It also meant that the new government could legislate economic policy. This included setting a minimum monthly production quota for cloth that would keep workers busy and paid. The new government also ended arrests for indebtedness. Moreover, they changed the public debt system that financed the city. This had generated tremendous profits for those citizens that were wealthy enough to buy in. Finally, they instituted basic social welfare policies to help the poor. Technically speaking, the revolt proper lasted only a few months when the most radical of the three new guilds, the Ciompi, were suppressed. The other two new guilds remained for several years, though, and they continued to exercise real power in Florence's government. It wasn't until 1382 that the remaining guilds were outlawed and power returned to the patrician elite of the city. The Ciompi Revolt was remarkable in its radicalism, but the form it took says a lot about medieval revolts in general. The Ciampi were mostly political in their immediate goals, and they often took quite conservative formats. The Ciampi were operating within the guild paradigm that dominated Florence. Want representation in government? Form a guild, rather than attacking the basic format of that government. But there were more radical possibilities out there. Just a few years after the Ciampi revolt, the most stunning rebellion of the Middle Ages rocked England to its core.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
The 1370s weren't kind to the Kingdom of England. The great Edward III, who had authored so many victories in the opening years of the Hundred Years' War, sank into old age. His promising sons had either died broken, like the Black Prince Edward, or they veered between competence and tone-deaf political idiocy, like John of Gaunt. Richard II came to the throne in 1377 as a 10-year-old boy, with councils of advisors who were desperately trying to hold on to order in the kingdom. So we talked last month about how the Hundred Years' War affected ordinary people. One of the biggest ways I mentioned was taxation. War was expensive, and it was the common folk of England and France who bore the burden. Naturally, that wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. If the war was going well, there was good pay for soldiers and a healthy supply of loot flowing back, then this was generally justifiable to the well-off, tax-paying peasants. If not, well, there could be real trouble. That was the major factor in the Jacquerie, remember? There were specific moments when those tensions between regular people and their increasingly extractive governments came to the surface. The biggest moment was when the tax collector came. 1381 was when those deeper issues of taxation and government boiled over in England. The crown was basically bankrupt. Years of increasingly heavy taxation, including universal poll taxes, had failed to make a dent in the expenditures. A parliament in November of 1380 estimated that a further £160,000, a staggering sum several times greater than the previous heavy taxes and many times the regular annual incomes of the government, well, that was what would be necessary just to keep the government afloat. In the words of Dan Jones, who wrote a really entertaining book on the rising called Summer of Blood that I'm using throughout this section, quote, "Reality began to bite." As May of 1381 rolled around, that reality really sank in. That was when the taxes were due. Tax officials appointed by the crown fanned out all across England to gather the money that each individual locality collected to meet its obligations. What those officials found was widespread tax fraud. In Essex, in southeastern England, the taxable population appeared to have fallen by more than a third in 4 years. There hadn't been a plague outbreak or anything that would explain this drop. Instead, it was obviously taxpayers finding ways not to list members of their households, especially unmarried women. This would allow them to avoid the poll tax that was levied on each individual person. The instructions for the officials investigating this mass tax avoidance were harsh. Quote, "Seize and arrest all those whom you find acting in opposition or rebellion to the above commands," they said, and imprisonment was to follow. To make matters worse, there were rumors of tax officials behaving poorly. They were harassing young women and taking bribes for favorable treatment of those avoiding their taxes. That's how the resistance started, with whispers of fraud and misdealings. Things came to a head on May 30th in the market town of Brentwood. Sir John de Brampton headed a peace commission, essentially an investigation into where the missing tax money was, where he called forward and interrogated representatives of villages in the area. They all complained about the high-handedness and demands of crown officials. Finally, Bampton brought forth a man named Peter Baker, the representative of a village called Fobbing. Bampton arrogantly ordered Baker and his Fobbing associates to tell him about the whereabouts of the required taxes. Baker replied that he and his fellow villagers had already paid Bampton himself earlier in the year. Now, they would pay nothing at all. The situation escalated. Bampton made threats. That might have seemed like a good idea, if the problem were a couple of recalcitrant peasants. But soon, everybody at the Peace Commission was up in arms. More than 100 villagers told Bampton, quote, they would not deal with him nor give him any money. Bampton and his associates fled just before the villagers could grab a hold of them. This was the beginning of the Great Peasants' Rebellion of 1381. Word spread quickly between communities in the area. Representatives of a number of villages gathered together at the village of Bocking and swore a solemn oath. It's unclear exactly what the representatives agreed to, but it seems likely that they decided to catch and kill royal ministers and officials, particularly those involved with taxes, and the local sheriff. Particularly harsh private lords were likewise targeted. From Bocking, the rebellion spread outwards with great speed. The pattern repeated itself all over the Essex and then the Kent countrysides in eastern England. Representatives of villages gathered together. They organized themselves. They swore an oath, and then they set off after their targets. This was not a spontaneous or an uncoordinated mob. As Dan Jones puts it, it was, quote, a carefully choreographed orgy of violence and retribution. So what exactly did that look like? The tight-fisted abbot of Lesness, master of a notoriously ill-disciplined and poorly run abbey, was forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the rebels on pain of death. One of the most important judges in the country, Sir Robert Belknap, was made to swear that he would never again participate in an inquest, the basic thing that judges did. Three jurors who had given information on that first batch of rebels from Brentwood were hunted down, killed, and beheaded. Their heads were stuck on poles, and the rebels carried them as grisly reminders of their purpose. It's important to remember here that the participants in the rising were not the dregs of society. Harvests had actually been quite good in the past few years. Living conditions were generally improving in the English countryside. That last piece is key. Things were actually getting better, not worse. This was a prosperous area. It was deeply commercialized. It was oriented toward profitable market exchange. People like Peter Baker and the other villagers thought that they were getting unfairly hammered by a hamstrung and irresponsible royal government. Rodney Hilton, the preeminent old historian of the rebellion, wrote, quote, the rebellion was no grain riot. It was human agencies rather than natural phenomena which were thwarting rising expectations. The agency, which most of the chroniclers chose to blame, was the government. This was a crisis that rose up in the short term, but it was the product of a decade of serious fiscal burdens and ongoing mismanagement. The increasingly prosperous small farmers of the English countryside, the wealthier peasants who had benefited most from the changes after the Black Death, well, they were fed up with an incompetent royal government. By June 7, 1381, a week after the events in Brentwood, Essex and Kent were in open rebellion. Local notables were marked for capture or death. They barricaded themselves in their castles and manor houses. Rochester Castle fell to the rebels. There was no royal army near there to suppress the peasants, and they had the run of the countryside. Support from London arrived. They told the country rebels that they would have support in England's greatest city if they headed that direction. It was at this point that two leaders emerged among the peasant rebels, Wat Tyler and John Ball. Tyler was an able leader, soldier, and organizer. He may have previously fought in the English armies that perpetually made their way to the continent to fight the French. Ball was a rabble-rousing preacher, a true extremist by the standards of the day, with a message of extreme egalitarianism. The combination of Tyler and Ball proved to be potent. The rebels took Chelmsford and burned any royal financial records they could find. Next, on June 11th, Tyler headed for Canterbury, the seat of the archbishop. The rebels demanded to know the identities of any quote-unquote traitors to King Richard and the Commons. They dragged these quote-unquote traitors into the street and beheaded them. Officials who had served on royal commissions and bailiffs who had enforced royal edicts were likewise murdered. Again, they burned any royal records, especially financial records, that they could find. royal messengers arrived. They demanded to know why the rebels were engaging in this kind of behavior. Tyler replied that they had risen to save the king from traitors. They would not stop. A coherent ideology was starting to emerge among the peasant rebels. It didn't want to do away with the king, very much the opposite. The rebels were focused on the cult of kingship. They acknowledged the figure of the king as the right and proper purveyor of justice to his kingdom of England. What they were against was all of those wicked counselors dispensing bad advice to the king. Dan Jones sums this up beautifully. The rebels were against, quote, all those dripping poison into the king's ear and spreading rot through the timber of government by their self-serving use of royal positions and power. The rebels, in their minds, were moral justice personified, the true commons of the kingdom. Despite the looting and the burning and the occasional murdering, this wasn't some spasm of indiscriminate violence. Instead, the rebels were carefully targeting particularly symbolic people and things. But this essentially political vision was fusing with something altogether more radical. After sacking Canterbury, the rebels headed for London, where they encamped on Blackheath, just outside the city. The 14-year-old King Richard II would come out to meet with the rebels and hear their demands. As they waited, John Ball gave a fire-breathing sermon. Quote, when Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman? Ball asked. He went on, quote, what have we deserved, or why should we thus be kept in servage? We be all come from one father and one mother, Adam and Eve. Whereby can they say or show that they be greater lords than we be, saving by that they cause us to win and labor for that they dispend? This was radically egalitarian. It was an attack on the basic class structure of medieval society. The king's barge rowed down the Thames toward the rebels, but it was stopped before Richard could go ashore to meet them. Instead, the rebels presented a detailed petition. They wanted the heads of John of Gaunt, the king's uncle and the preeminent nobleman of the kingdom, Simon Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Royal Chancellor, the bishops of London and Durham, the Chief Justice, and the Chief Baron of the Exchequer. Faced with this list of heads to be taken, two of whom were on the royal barge with Richard II, the king turned around and headed back to the city. This, on June 13th, was the breaking point for the rebels. They entered London and met up with a mob of city rebels, then opened the prisons. They burned John of Gaunt's magnificent palace. They seized a wealthy and impossibly corrupt lawyer named Roger Leggett and beheaded him on Cheapside, one of the city's main streets. That was one of 18 killings of quote-unquote traitors that day. The London Priory of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, the Hospitaller Knights, was likewise burned. Things devolved from there. Richard II did finally meet with the rebels, and he gave them exactly what they were asking for. Freedom from serfdom, and free rein to catch and kill any quote-unquote traitors they could find. The rebels walked into the Tower of London. They seized Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and beheaded him. The executioners nailed his red mitre, the hat that marked his office as archbishop, to his skull. Sudbury's was one of a number of heads impaled on London Bridge. The mob ruled the city. Rich merchants went under the axe. So did despised foreigners, especially the Flemish. On June 15th, just 2 weeks after the initial incident in Brentwood, Richard again met with the rebels, this time with Wat Tyler himself. Tyler laid out a wildly egalitarian demand for reforms, an end not just to serfdom, but to all lordship, the end of the church hierarchy and large-scale land redistribution. Richard told Tyler and his men to go home. The 14-year-old Richard faced down Tyler. Tyler broke first. He asked for a jug of water, which he then spat at Richard's feet. This was disrespectful. Someone in the royal party called out that Tyler was nothing more than a common thief. This drove Tyler crazy, and he pulled out a dagger, then tried to stab the mayor of London, a guy named William Walworth. The blade bounced off the armor that the mayor was wearing, and in return, Walworth plunged his own dagger into Tyler's neck, then into his head. Tyler fell from his horse, mortally wounded. Richard seized the moment. He called on the rebels to follow him to another open space nearby. spellbound, with their leader Tyler down, they did so. The mayor rode back to London, where companies of armed citizens were gathering to repel the rebels. Returning to the scene of the showdown between Tyler and Richard, Walworth found Tyler lying near dead in a hospital. The mayor dragged the dying Tyler outside, propped him up, and cut off his head. Walworth then carried the head to the waiting rebels and Richard. All the fight went out of them. They packed off and headed back for Kent. Retribution came quickly. Walworth was put in charge of a commission to exact immediate and exceptionally harsh revenge on any in London who had participated. Rebels were dragged into the street and executed on the spot. Flemish wives whose husbands had been murdered by the mob were given axes and allowed to personally decapitate their killers. But this wasn't the end. The rising had gone national. There were still burnings and murders across Norfolk and Cambridgeshire, and the rebellion was active as far north as York. It took a royal army led by Richard himself and the capture of John Ball to finally put an end to things. Ball was finally captured a few weeks later, sometime in July. Then he was hanged, disemboweled, beheaded, and his body was chopped into quarters. The four pieces of his body were sent to four different parts of the country as a warning to any other would-be rebels. The killings continued. Royal commissioners reportedly had some former rebels dragged to death behind horses, they had others hanged, and still others were dismembered. The rebellion was over. This was revenge. Now, the rebellion of 1381 wasn't the last revolt of the Middle Ages. Far from it. Jack Cade's rebellion in 1450, which we talked about in an episode on the Hundred Years' War, was much more sophisticated in its political program. The Hussite Rebellion in Bohemia, which we'll discuss a little bit next month on Tides, was more successful in the long term. But the Rebellion of 1381 was one of the most successful and the largest in scale. It was the most radical in its demands. Most of all, it's striking evidence of the roiling unrest that lay just beneath the surface of medieval society. As we saw in all of the cases we talked about today, it took only a trigger and a few days for highly organized bands of peasants to raise the whole countryside in revolt. The brutal repressions that inevitably followed showed just how terrified medieval elites were of these rebellions and how right they were to fear them. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be turning our attention toward the late medieval church and late medieval religion more generally. The 14th and 15th centuries were a time of enormous trials for the church, with exile from Rome and schism dominating the landscape. After that, we'll discuss a few fascinating and deeply disturbing aspects of late medieval and early modern religion: heresy, witch hunts, and Inquisition. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. The producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.